Okay, so here we are, week four actually, isn't it? It's week four. I know. Week four, I know it's, everybody was more hopeful, I guess. Week four, and we're going to talk about normativity. Normativity, as I've actually brought this concept up several times in the lecture so far, and it is one of the things that unifies both the study of law and sociology and the other social sciences as well. And it has to do with the degree of regularity that exists in social relations. But in particular, what is the basis for it? What is the basis for this kind of regularity? This is a tricky issue. And I think part of the issue has to do with what one takes... Well, a few issues. The first issue has to do with whether there's something naturally regular about the way human beings are. So if we talk about something called human nature, what does that mean exactly? Okay. I think it's been quite common in the modern period to think that, as it were, there are some kind of law-like ways in which human beings interact with each other naturally. And so it's in relation to that that you can talk about whether the actual laws enacted in a society are just or not, right? And natural law theory appeals to this kind of idea, right? So I think one of the things that I said early on in the discussion of natural law theory is that you can have unjust laws being made, but then there's a right to revolt, right? Because in some sense, those unjust laws go against the laws of human nature, and that's what natural law would protect. So you might say what would be these laws? Well, these would be the kinds of laws that nowadays we might associate with human rights. Right? Certain things that, you know, the human being, in order to be treated properly and as a human being, right? So this is kind of an idea that the sort of laws that ought to be enacted for human beings ought to, in some sense, be responsive to the nature of human beings. And if human beings are endowed, either through biology or through God or whatever, with certain kinds of capacities that entitle us to a certain level of dignity, then that needs to be respected by the law, you know, the laws that are enacted. And if those laws do not abide by the laws of human nature, then people have the right to get rid of them. Even perhaps violent revolution. So there's that one sense, and you might say that's a kind of sense of normativity that has to do with the nature of human beings. And this idea of natural law is one that still remains with us. I think I pointed that out, and often gets used as a kind of way of judging whether already existing laws are appropriate or not. Even though nowadays when we talk about natural law in this sense, we're not necessarily appealing to God or anything in the process. However, the problem of normativity can also be understood in a much broader kind of way to cover what is it that makes any kind, that gives any kind of law force. So we're not just talking about, you know, because in a sense, natural law appeals to a very specific kind of normativity, namely normativity that's tied to the nature of our humanity. So it's a very substantive notion of normativity. But the kind of normativity, and when I say substantive in the Max Weber sense, what I mean is it's tied to the content of what it means to be a human being. It's very specific in that sense. But when we talk about the basis for normativity in the law, as we do in sociology, we typically mean something that's a bit broader and can be captured by the idea of on what basis should we follow the law? Right? Where does the force of the law come from? The force of the law. Now, the force of the law can be talked about in many different ways. And all these different ways have to do with issues of normativity. So we can talk about whether the laws are legal, the legality of the law. And that's to say, how does a particular law fit into the general body of law? And this is a kind of notion that Hans Kelsen, the modern legal theorist of the legal positivist tradition, was very much into. But there's also another notion, and this one is associated with Weber, and this is the idea of legitimacy. And legitimacy has to do less with the relationship of the laws to other laws than, as it were, the relationship between the people making the laws and the people following the laws. Right? So is the law being enforced by a legitimate authority? That's ultimately a question about particular people in relation to other people. Okay? So does the king have legitimacy? Do the police have legitimacy? Do the courts have legitimacy? Right? These are kinds of questions we might ask as well. And in a sense, the force of the law could come from that. And so now this notion of force then is a kind of interesting idea to explore, because force in this context has two kinds of meanings. In Kelsen's sense, if you want to talk about the force of the law, the legality of the law in that sense, we're really talking about something that's pretty close to logical force. Okay? And so we've got, the notion of validity, right? The validation of the law. Now this is where, here is where I think it becomes important to understand kind of how Kelsen scopes out the problem of normativity. At the end of the day, for Kelsen, the normativity of the law, of any given law, is its derivability from the fundamental norm. Right, the Grundnorm, the fundamental law. And this is, you might understand this as some kind of constitutional statement. Right, so the foundation of the law, the constitution in countries that have such things. And so you can tell, if you say, where does the force of the law come from? If you're Kelsen, it comes from the ability to derive any given law from the Grundnorm through some kind of logical operation. Now, what does this logical operation amount to? Well, in practice, it has to do with how legislation is framed, right? So when legislators get together and they draft laws, how do they do it? Well, the first thing they look at is what laws are already there. And basically, what is it that the Constitution allows them to do? What kind of, what are the rules of the game, as it were, that's set up by the Constitution within which they can then make laws to cover things they want to cover? And then, of course, there are additional things. There are judicial interpretations of the law, judicial decisions, okay? And those too are a figure, and they also provide various kinds of constraints. But you see, this way of thinking about the legality of the law is very much, you might say, by the book, right? It's very much looking at the law, as text, and looking at the way in which the various texts relate to each other. And so in principle, if you take Kelsen seriously, you could actually do something like a flowchart, some kind of logical flowchart, showing how a particular given law relates to all the other laws that it's derived from. And that would be the sum total of what you'd need to do in order to explain the legality of the law and where does the normativity come from. And so for Kelsen, the normativity ultimately comes from this foundational norm, the Grundnorm, the Constitution, and so all the other laws, as it were, derive their force from it. So Kelsen really does think about the law as kind of a logical system, one that is constantly being elaborated and exfoliated over time. Now, it's an interesting feature of his theory that he sees this as a very uniquely human activity, in the sense that he doesn't actually believe that nature has anything like this. Okay, so he's a really radically anti-natural law. Right, because remember, one of the things that I said about natural law's theory was that natural law operates on a kind of assumption, let's say, that God, as it were, does the laws of nature, and then the laws that we do on earth are kind of small versions of this, basically, right? That there's a kind of microcosm, macrocosm relationship between the laws of nature and the laws of humans. This is on the natural law theory, because God's the ultimate lawmaker, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Kelsen denies this, right? And so in this respect, right, the Grundnorm and the foundation of the law is always a very artificial thing. It doesn't relate to anything else but itself. And you may recall, I think it may have been last week, and maybe even the previous week as well, in Greek, this distinction between phusis and nomos, remember that? Right, where in Greek, nature, which is phusis, is without law. Right, it's fate, it's chance, it's just the way it is. Whereas nomos is law, but it's human law. It's the only law there is human law, the law that's constructed. Well, Kelsen thinks this way, right? So the Grundnorm is all about nomos. There is no law in phusis. Okay, that's an important point. Now this is interesting because in principle what this means, if you're Kelsen, is that anything could be the foundation, right? Anything could be the foundation. And in fact, one of the things that's interesting is that while you know, someone might criticize Kelsen for saying, but come on, you can't imagine, the normativity of the law can't be that arbitrary. In other words, the foundations of the law could be in principle anything, and then all the laws just need to be derived from it. It couldn't be that arbitrary. Well, his argument was against this position, was that as a matter of fact, when we make judgments about whether other legal systems are legitimate, we basically judge them by whether they've been constructed in the way we have constructed our legal system. Okay? And so he gives examples of the problem. I mean, one of the interesting issues of international law was how do you recognize, under what circumstances do you recognize the law of a new regime of another country? Okay, especially one where the regime is predicated on a radical change of constitution, typically through revolution. Okay, how do you, under what circumstances do you recognize it? And one of the things that Kelsen said historically is that historically, we tend to only recognize the laws of countries that have constructed their laws similarly to the way we have. Okay? So in other words, the lawmaking process has its own kind of autonomy. So it took a long time, for example, for after the French Revolution, for the revolutionary government of France to get any kind of recognition, even though it held the power in the society, because the laws were not constructed according to the principle that had been recognized in Europe at the time in the late 18th century, which was always that there was some absolute monarch sovereign who stood behind the laws. This is even true in this country, of course, as you know. This is why the queen has this kind of symbolic presence, but it is a legally recognized presence as being kind of the ultimate source from which all the laws, you know, the legitimacy of the law derives. Well, this was true across all of Europe. The revolutionary French government after 1789 got rid of that, wrote its own constitution, but did not have any role for a monarch at all. Okay? And Kelsen's point was, very few nations recognize this. Okay? And in fact, in some cases, France was not recognized again until the monarchy was reinstalled and Napoleon and things like this, because there wasn't a properly constructed legal system. This is not to say that there wasn't, you know, law in the behavioral sense of, you know, people enforcing certain kinds of principles under certain circumstances, but the way in which these laws were brought into being was not seen to be in the way in which the European countries had recognized laws being brought into being. A similar thing happened with the Russian Revolution in 1917. Okay, another revolutionary overthrow. And of course, by the time you get to 1917, it's not necessary to have a monarch, you know, that's written into your constitution as backing the legitimacy of all your laws. That wasn't the problem with the Russian Revolution. The problem with the Russian Revolution was it abolished private property and severely restricted the right to contract. And you see, that's a fundamental principle of the modern legal system, as I've pointed out in the kind of modern liberal legal systems that we're mostly familiar with these days, right? The right to contract is a very central kind of notion, especially when it comes to defining the ability of individuals to exercise their freedom in a legal fashion. Okay? And the Russian Revolution suspended that. Okay? And so, again, even though the new Russian regime was able to enforce order on the country, nevertheless, it was not recognized as legitimate because of the way in which its constitution was constructed. Okay? So, Kelsen's point here is that, as a matter of fact, it is quite conventional and quite artificial, the criteria that we use by which to define whether a given regime is actually legal. Okay? And in fact, we tend to model it on the way in which we construct our own legal systems. And so Kelsen's view was that the only way you could get something like international law in some kind of binding sense, and he was one of the guys who was very interested in developing a League of Nations after World War I, right? The League of Nations being this prototype for what became the United Nations after World War II, right? That the way you had to develop the League of Nations was going to be to come up with sort of the common principles of legal construction across all nations. There has to be some things that they do in common, even though they have substantive disagreements, even though they don't all, you know, emphasize the same rights, right? Nevertheless, there must be some common principles of construction, and those common principles of construction could serve as a basis for international law. So he did not imagine that international law would necessarily have a substantive notion of human rights attached to it. Because if you notice with the United Nations, of course, the United Nations is quite interesting in that there is a substantive notion of human rights, which is enshrined in the Universal Declaration. But Kelsen didn't imagine this to be the case, right? That the status of persons, the status of human beings, are in the last instance constructions of the law itself. They do not pre-exist the law. What counts as a legal agent, legal entity? Persons are artificial all the way down, as far as Kelsen is concerned, and it's through the Grundnorm that any person actually gets a standing in the law. Okay, so this is an interesting kind of position. If you read Stephen Turner's chapter 3 of his book Explaining the Normative, where he's comparing Kelsen and Weber, he makes a very interesting, Kelsen, in one of his writings, where he's explaining this Grundnorm idea and exactly how seriously, you know, because in a way the description of the Grundnorm and the way in which legality is constructed for Kelsen sounds to a certain extent arbitrary. It really does. It sounds like, well, whatever is the first principles of the law, that pretty much determines it, and it could be anything. Right? And so the reason why we don't recognize other countries is because they're not like us. It's as simple as that. Right? There's nothing substantive, as it were, that would bind the countries. You have to actually get it from the first principles, constructing it. So Kelsen relies on the thinking of a neo-Kantian philosopher. So the neo-Kantian philosophers, you'll see Turner talks about this. You're familiar with Kant, Immanuel Kant, okay? So we go back a little bit here. So Immanuel Kant is actually the person who we normally regard as having coined the term Enlightenment to describe the 18th century, the Great Age of Reason. He was a philosopher who lived at the end of that period, wrote the Critique of Pure Reason, is usually regarded as the most influential modern philosopher, Immanuel Kant, okay? And so he's living, he wrote the Critique of Pure Reason in 1781. And the thing that makes this work so important, and people who follow him Kantians, is that there is this very strong distinction Kant makes, it goes throughout his writing, between the way the world is in itself, the way nature is, let's say, and the human constitution, the constitution of the human mind. Okay? And you could see somebody like Kelvin having this kind of idea, right? So Phusis is just nature as it is, but then all the action has to do with what the human beings do. And that's the source of all meaning. Nature itself doesn't have any meaning independently of the meaning that we construct or impose on it. You're familiar with this view, I suppose. This is Kant, right? Kant in a kind of vulgarized version, but it's probably the version you have run across. And Kelsen is part of this tradition. No doubt about it. He's part of this tradition. And you know, by the time you get to somebody like Weininger here, who's living in the end of the 19th century, okay, so he's living 100 years after Kant, this idea of the human constitution of the world, of the fact that the world of meaning is a human construction, gets very much associated with philosophies of the will. Right? In other words, we make it happen. Okay? Because you might, you know, Kant's right, if you read Kant, Kant is primarily talking about a kind of conceptual or psychological construction of the world, the way we perceive the world. But when you get to the end of the 19th century, this doctrine gets taken in a much more embodied direction, and it becomes willing the world, making things happen. Okay? And of course, this very much fits in with how one might think about the law. Because, you know, there is this whole line of largely positivist legal thinking that starts with Thomas Hobbes, and Kelsen, in a sense, is part of that tradition, right? Which basically says, the law is what the lawmakers say it is, right? The people who lay down the Constitution, right, they determine what the law is. And it's their words that matter. And hence the law is constructed. You know, and then and whereas Kelsen interprets this in purely logical terms, one might think of this in a much more kind of power-oriented way. It's not just the force of reason from first premises that leads you to subsequent laws, but rather it is the authority or the power of the agencies of the law who want to enforce those first principles that then make everything else happen in the society. Okay? And so this is kind of, in a way, you might say, there is a kind of continuity between somebody like Hobbes and somebody like Kant, and then moving on to people like Weininger and Kelsen. Now, Weininger has a very interesting distinction. A hypothesis versus a fiction. By the way, this is in a book called The Philosophy of As If. As if, right? You know this phrase, as if, right? Which suggests it's not the case. And what this is what this idea that Weininger has, and it's a very interesting, it's basically a study of the status of things that we know not to be true. What kind of status do they have in the world? But things that in some sense, nevertheless, we treat as true. And by true, I mean something that can be empirically validated independently of the will of the agent. You know, a fact of the matter about the world that doesn't rely on my thinking. So, for example, we can think about a hypothesis. A hypothesis is a view of the world that you invent, but then you test against the world. And in a sense, the way you learn something is through a kind of contradiction, right? You think something is the case, you do an experiment where you test a hypothesis, and the experiment turns out to be false. And so there's a sense in which this is a very sort of self-conscious way of realizing the difference between what you're imagining and how the world is. Okay? And science proceeds this way, obviously. So in a sense, a hypothesis, you take seriously the idea you could be wrong. You already know this in advance. You already know you might be wrong. That's the important part. However, the notion of fiction is different. The way Weininger uses the word fiction is not hypothesis. A fiction is something that is false in the sense that it does not correspond to reality, but it hides that fact. The way he puts it is, it doesn't contradict reality, it contradicts itself. It doesn't reveal its own falseness. Okay? It's a bit like virtual reality, right? Where in a sense you inhabit it. It doesn't correspond to the world, but you never discover that. Because you're in it. And that's what he calls fiction. Okay? And when you're reading fiction, think about it. When you're reading fiction, right, and you're enjoying fiction, you're not thinking about the story from the standpoint of whether it's true of the world. No, you get into the world and you inhabit that world. And that becomes your world for a while. It's still not the real world, but your attitude toward it is different. Okay, I hope you see this distinction between a hypothesis and a fiction. Because Kelsen believes law is a fiction. That's the thing. Law is a fiction in this sense. So what he's saying is, law is clearly something that in some sense is cooked up. Right? In a sense, the foundation of the law, how we begin the law, is arbitrary. What the Constitution is could be anything. However, we suspend disbelief. In other words, we don't kind of linger on the fact that this Constitution is arbitrary. No, we treat it as if it were true. And then everything else is derived from that. Okay, you see the idea. So the law is a fiction in this specific sense. Right? It is false, strictly speaking, in that there is no particular reason why the laws have to be this way or that way. But the point is, we inhabit these laws, and we treat them as real, and so they constitute reality for us, but only for us. That is to say, only for us in the law. Just like the fiction that you read is only real for the reader. The fiction you read in the novel is not referring to some external reality. It is real to you as the reader as you're enjoying it. And this is why it's kind of like this notion of fiction, I think, relates very nicely to the notion of virtual reality. Virtual reality has this character to it. Where part of what you do when you get into virtual reality is that you forget it's virtual. Right? You kind of experience it and live it. This is the sense. So when we talk about the law is fiction, and you may have heard this expression before, right, that the laws are fiction, this is what we mean. It's a pretty deep idea, I think. And so what this does, this is kind of Kelsen's way of getting around the fact that he doesn't want any kind of substantive content to the foundation of the law. He doesn't, so this is partly a response to avoid natural law theory. This is how you avoid natural law theory. Because natural law theory ultimately goes back to the idea that all laws have to have certain kind of substantial assumptions, particularly about the nature of human beings. And that and if you don't have those assumptions, then the law is not legitimate. But Kelsen wants to remove that condition. He wants, in some sense, for the law to be self-justifying. That the law can be justified without bringing anything extra-legal to justify it. And what that means is, given the existence of multiple legal systems, each of which are founded in radically different foundations, then in some sense you're going to have to justify the arbitrariness of the law. At least the arbitrariness of the first principles. What is not arbitrary about the law, and this is Kelsen's point, is the way in which subsequent laws are derived from the Grundnorm. Right? So all the laws that are made by the legislators, all the laws that are made by the courts, those have to be derived from the Grundnorm. But the Grundnorm itself is artificial and can be arbitrary. Okay, so this is the idea. So it's an idea of law as fiction. Now, this is quite an idea, and it's very powerful in a way, because what it does is, you might say, it gives a kind of freedom to the law to develop on its own, right? I mean, because here's the thing. One reason why natural law theory has historically often been conservative in the way it is operated, not always, of course, but when it has been conservative, it's been because there is this tendency to go back
to some substantive foundational principle. Okay? So when we talk about human nature, for example, as being something that might be part of natural law, we usually have a certain kind of conception of the human being, that has to do with the sanctity of the body and things like this. And what it doesn't really allow for is the possibility that human beings may exist well under radically different conditions. Okay? One of the things that I was mentioning, I think, in the lecture or in the seminar, was that a lot of the controversies, let's say, over embryonic stem cell research, right, and a lot of these more fancy biotech things that are coming on stream, which may involve, xenotransplantations of various sorts. That's to say, the placing of non-human organs or non-human cells into human beings. Maybe very substantial, major organs like kidneys and hearts and livers and things like this, right? That idea of putting that into a human being and developing research, turning cells into organ farms, all this kind of stuff, right? Part of the way in which natural law recoils from this is by saying that in some sense it violates the dignity of the human being in terms of the bodily integrity of the human being. This is a substantive assumption that comes from natural law theory, which can be packed into the law. Now, what that does, potentially, is to make it difficult for us to experiment with alternative modes of embodiment. Just like natural law theory often gets invoked to say there are two genders, right? And then there aren't 12 or 13 or as many you wish, or a continuum or mix and match. And you can't flip-flop between them every other week. No, this is natural law theory speaking too. Okay? And what this all these moves have in common is the idea that there are substantive notions about what's natural for the human being that the law needs to uphold, and what that does, in effect, is to constrain the development of the law in light of new, developments within science and technology in particular. Right, so in that respect, the law acts conservatively. Now, if you're Kelsen, you that's not there, right? There isn't those substantive assumptions about the human being, and so in principle, that actually allows the law more freedom to explore different possibilities, because something like the category of a person is an artificial construct within the law. And of course, human beings may be the paradigm case of persons, but what makes something a person is going to be the kind of cluster of rights and obligations that are associated with that being and how they're enforced. And in principle, that being could be anything. Right? It could be an animal. Or it could be some human-animal hybrid or cyborg. I mean, it could be... There's nothing in the Kelsen conception that would prohibit this, as long as it fits the constructed definition of what a person is, because there are no substantive assumptions to the law. I think this is quite an important point, because this, in a way, this is kind of the strength of Kelsen's view, right? That it actually allows the law to develop in a fairly free manner. It gives it a kind of independence, okay? And I think it's pretty clear, given the amount of legal innovation that takes place in light of new developments in society and science and so forth, that I think the legal profession likes this move, right? In a sense, this is kind of, from the standpoint of the lawyer, right, the legal practitioner, it seems to me that the Kelsen picture is kind of attractive in this regard. Okay? Because it gives the law a lot of freedom. Now, I want to, are there questions at this point? I want to make sure people get this point. Are people getting this? Because this is kind of an interesting but maybe subtle point. So are people following what's going on here? Do people have any questions at this point about Kelsen and the Grundnorm and the lack of a substantive basis for the law? Does anyone want to ask anything on this? No? Everybody's cool with this? Okay. How many people buy it? How many like this idea? You like it? Oh, some do, some don't. Tell me who like. Put your hands up if you like it. If you like Kelsen's view. All right? How many don't like it? There you go. Okay? Why don't you like it? Because I know you're always good for words. Why don't you like it?
I think it's inherently biased because his presupposition is being conservative is problematic.
Yes, yes. Well, okay, so, but the thing is, he's saying that in the face of the law needs to be able to develop freely in light of changes in the world and things like that.
I get that, but then where do you draw the boundaries? I think it's a slippery slope.
A slippery slope to what exactly?
Well, that depends on your worldview, but it's a slippery slope to literally just justifying anything that one person feels is of importance to them, therefore the law should cater to that.
Well, I mean, I think the issue here is going to be whether you can construct the argument within the law, right? So, I mean, so in this respect, right, the law still has this kind of universal scope. So let's say, you know, let's say you're the sort of person who wants the law to be organized so you're allowed to do something, right? On the Kelsen system, that's going to have to be derived from something that will then enable anyone else in your position to do it as well.
So it sets a precedent.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, because remember, that's still part of the, you know, while the foundations are arbitrary, the way you derive the subsequent laws is logically determined by the previous laws. It's just the first step is arbitrary. And that's, you know, so there's no substantive assumptions about human beings or anything in the first. It's just formal principles. You didn't like it either. Why didn't you like it?
I just think that there's no boundary to, like, morality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you believe that there should be some kind of moral foundation to the law. Okay, so you're sort of a natural law theorist. Yeah, yeah. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. Actually, natural law is, it still has a lot, you know, a lot of followers and adherents, and certainly when we talk about human rights as an idea would never have got off the ground if it weren't for natural law theory. Okay? Because this stuff is not going to give you natural law theory. What this gave you, of course, as you know, Kelsen and Max Weber worked on the Weimar Constitution, right? After World War I, right? The first democratic constitution of Germany, right? Which if you, again, I don't know how many of you have ever seen the Weimar Constitution. It is a marvel to behold, right? It is incredibly articulated. It's got all kinds of rules. It makes possible the, I was talking to this in the seminar group last week. It gave formal recognition to all kinds of self-identifying groups. So the kinds of agents who had legal representation within the Weimar Republic were multifarious. It wasn't just individuals. There was identity politics going on all over the place. It licensed demonstrations, protests, all these things that we now associate, you know, with kind of modern, left politics. It was invented from a legal standpoint within the Weimar Constitution as part of the legal construction. And as I also pointed out, this led to enormous gridlock in the system, because everybody was basically playing the law their own way, and the law allowed for all of these different things to happen. Because the law didn't have an actual kind of normative constraint other than to maximize the freedom and the expression of people. And so it was all set out to do that. So it was very democratic in that sense. Okay? But it was very difficult to use as an instrument for any kind of, you know, nationwide legislation during a period, as you know, the 1920s in Germany and 1930s were incredibly volatile economically, politically, and everything else. And this constitution was just too weak. It couldn't absorb all that because it allowed too much freedom in a sense. Okay? So there are interesting lessons to learn about this. And I think if you look at the League of Nations, which Kelsen was also involved in, that failed too, right? And there was something of a similar problem there as well. And that's one of the reasons why after World War II, the natural law tradition comes back with a vengeance. Right? You know, because most of the legal theorists, if you know something about the history of the law, most of the legal theorists that you will have read about from, let's say, from the 19th and 20th centuries until World War II will have been some kind of positivist, okay? Will have been someone who believes basically laws are made by humans and it's artificial and conventional and all that kind of stuff. That's pretty much, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, John Austin, you know, in the beginning of the positivist tradition around in the late 1790s, right, all the way up to Kelsen in the 1920s and 30s. But then after World War II, because of the way all these legal systems that got constructed this way were subject to so much, you know, manipulation, basically, then you start to get some more natural law notions that come back into fashion. And that's why with the UN, you know, the UN Charter, you have this Declaration of Human Rights front and center. Substantive assumptions about the human condition have to be a basis for any kind of legitimate law. That was a new move, okay? And so in this respect, Kelsen is from, you know, his thinking is very pre-World War II. Okay, so I do think Kelsen's view of things is very interesting, and I actually do think it has a lot of, it's going to have a lot of relevance, I think, in the future, because especially when we get to the final weeks of the course where we talk about all of these challenges from animal rights and android rights and all these rights, you know, that are on the table, how to actually come up with a legal system that can accommodate them without being substantively prejudiced. Right? Because one of the arguments that animal rights people in particular make against our human rights-based natural law is that, you know, human rights is speciesist. You've heard of this. It's like racist, right? Speciesist. Right? Law is biased to human beings. Look at that UN Charter. That UN Charter is only about humans. That's all they care about. Forget about animals. Right? And so, when you start to get those kinds of challenges, then something like Kelsen starts to look interesting again. Because Kelsen doesn't come in with these substantive assumptions that the law is just by and for humans. Right? It's a completely much more open kind of foundational system. So we're going to get back to talk about this as we get to the end of the course. Okay, one thing that I want to say in talking about just in the next few minutes before we have to go about Max Weber in all this is that Weber at one level actually agrees with everything Kelsen says, right? In the sense that if you do a comparative, let's say you do a comparative sociology of the law, which is kind of what Weber was up to, and you look at the way in which law gets constructed in many different societies at different times in history and so forth, it's actually very difficult to find common substantive assumptions, right? I mean, and this is why Weber's argument was, you know, that rather than focusing, as Kelsen does, on this kind of abstract notion of a Grundnorm, one should just, you know, go back to the Hobbesian point and say, look, what gives the law legitimacy? Who's got the power, right? Who's enforcing this? Whose will matters, right? And there you can make some interesting distinctions among different legal systems, how the power is delegated, how the power is put into force, and all the rest of this. And so when Weber talks about legitimacy as opposed to legality, what he's talking about is the mobilization of power around statements of law. Okay? And this is, of course, a very important point, because Kelsen is really interested in the kind of formal logical derivation of laws from first principles. He's not really interested in the question of power. He's interested in the question of logical force, not political force. Okay? And this is where he and Weber differ, right? Namely, where should the emphasis be placed? Now, Weber, one place where Weber and Kelsen may disagree in particulars has to do with whether force is, under what circumstances would force be legitimate. And here, I think Weber has a very much power politics view of this. Namely, whoever is in control of enforcing the law at its various levels, they are the ones who matter, in a sense. Okay? And in that regard, he's, you know, there is this term in German, Machtpolitik, power politics, which is to say that in this respect, the law is a kind of veil or a mask
for power relations. Right? And if you really want to know who, you know, how the law gets enforced, what sorts of laws are made and not made, right? Because Kelsen, in a way, tells you how to logically justify a whole range of laws from first principles. But what Kelsen does not explain is why are only certain laws made and not other laws, even though the other laws would also be as consistent with the first principles. Right? Why are certain areas of the law developed the way they are and enforced the way they are? Whereas other areas of law that are, in a way, in principle, just as legal, get ignored entirely. Okay? So, for example, we have enormously developed corporate law. Okay? Why? Because corporate lawyers are constantly testing it. Right? And if you test the law a lot, then you get very articulate law. Law gets made around the cases. And so you have a very highly developed, articulate system. But other areas of the law, where there isn't so much legal testing, it's underdeveloped. Now you see, that's an interesting point. And this is the kind of thing that Weber would point to as saying, look, how are the power differentials being played out in society? That will tell you something of how the flow of legitimacy goes in society. Okay, so this is where I would say Weber and Kelsen would be different. But they would be in agreement that fundamentally the foundations of the law are pretty arbitrary, right? They vary. There is no common foundation to the law. Neither of them are natural law theorists at all. I mean, the interesting thing, and this is going to be the thing that we talk about next week, is whether in some sense, even if you take this view of the law that I've been describing, which is to say the law is pretty much something you make up, nevertheless, you can talk about improving it, right? In other words, making better laws for purposes of achieving the kind of society you want. Because you can aim for that, treating the law as an instrument, even if you don't believe in any deep principles of natural law, right? You can have basically this kind of view of law and nevertheless think that the laws can be improved. Why? In relation to certain kinds of goals that you would like to see the law realize. And that's what all these legal realists are about, right? And we're going to deal with them next week. And this is the part of the law, school of law, largely American, which has been very much aligned to progressive politics in the United States in the 20th century. Yeah?
But isn't it that under not natural law?
Well, the Kelsen style law.
Yeah, the whole point is that it can be improved, whereas natural law is more difficult for it to be improved.
Yeah. No. That's right. That's right. It's not. Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, yes, it can be improved and be developed and all the rest of it. But what I'm talking about here is not just the law being improved and developed in itself, right? Because Kelsen would be interested in making the laws consistent, right? Following out the implications of the law, all understood within the legal framework. I'm talking about people who are going to use the law for purposes of improving society. Right? So it's a much more instrumental view of the law. But these people often have assumptions about the law that aren't too different from Kelsen's. Okay? In other words, they believe it's constructed, it's cooked up by humans, but it can also be used to improve the human condition. So that's what we're talking about with legal realism, a kind of instrumental use of the law that was very much involved in the progressive side of American politics in the 20th century. Okay? So we'll talk about that next week. I think we need to get going now. All right?